I'm Frank Gallagher, host of Soundman Confidential. It's showtime. Plug in. Drummer, give me kick, snare and hi-hat. Those words might have been the first thing I said to my guest on today's show. The year was 1977. He and his bandmates were kicking off the first date of a European tour with the Ramones in Zurich, Switzerland. I was running the board. A few years previously, he had formed a band with his pal David on guitar and had convinced his girlfriend Tina to play bass. Talking Heads was born. When I get to work with a great drummer, it's the best feeling. And Chris France is a great drummer. Later, I worked with him and Tina Weymouth mixing for Tom Tom Club. We're good friends to this day. And if you haven't listened to my chat with Tina on episode 2, please check it out. It's a cracker. And get your hands on Chris's recently published memoir, Remain in Love, for the inside track on the story of Talking Heads. So sit down. Here we go. Chris France on Soundman Confidential. Enjoy.
You rang?
Hello, Chris. Give me a quick 1-2 for the sound check.
1-2. Buckle my shoe. 3-4. Shut the door.
All right. Fantastic. Good morning. Please introduce yourself.
Oh, good morning. My name is Chris France. Drummer for Talking Heads and Tom Tom Club and author of Remain in Love.
Fantastic. Yeah, you got a lot. Yeah. You've got a lot going on, laddie.
I do. Yeah.
Well, I talked to one of my ex-employers this morning, Susie Quattro. She sends her very best regards to you and Tina.
And oh, good. And yeah, somebody said they saw the documentary about Susie Quattro last night, and they really enjoyed it.
I watched it also. I watched it late last night and saw your good self and Tina there contributing, and she was very grateful for that.
Oh, well, it was a pleasure. I hope they got my good side, Frank.
Oh, you don't have a bad side, laddie. So let's go back to where we first met for the record, it was 1977, and what are your recollections of that?
Well, we flew Talking Heads, our band flew. It was my first trip to Europe. We were doing a tour as support band for the Ramones, and it was April of 1977, and we flew into Zurich, Switzerland. That was where the first show was, at the Volkshaus, a very nice venue.
Yes.
At the time, it was one of the nicest venues we'd ever played, probably the nicest. And you were the sound man that was assigned to our band. The Ramones brought their own guy, but we didn't have a sound man at that point, so the nice people, the good people at Concert Sound assigned you to Talking Heads, and it was really great, wasn't it?
It was indeed. It was a very fortuitous meeting.
Yeah, I think that was not only my first trip to Europe, but it was also my first proper sound check.
Yeah.
And I can remember you saying, drummer, you know, bass drum and snare drum and tom-toms, cymbals, and then bass player, play along with him.
That was it.
And it was quite a show. I think it was sold out, wasn't it?
It was a sold out show, and I think I only got like a song and a half of a sound check with you, and then they opened the doors.
So you got the gig, Frank.
I did. It was for me. It was instant. Kind of once I got a grip on the mix, it was. And then I got to know, over the next few shows, I got to know some of the songs more intimately. Because up to that point, Talking Heads only had one single out as an import and the album was an import in the UK. So
yeah, the album wasn't even out. We hadn't even finished mixing our album yet.
Yeah.
All we had was that single "Love Goes to Building on Fire."
Right.
And it was getting in Europe. It was actually getting a little bit of airplay because the European radio stations were a lot more sympathetic to new bands than radio stations in America were. So we were getting airplay maybe in Switzerland. I know we were getting it in the Netherlands and also a little bit in the UK and a little bit in France.
Yeah. Germany. I think Germany, they were playing a little here and there.
Uh-huh. But we didn't go to Germany on that tour. That was the next tour.
Yeah.
I was going to say that the enticement for the young people to come to this particular show with the Talking Heads and the Ramones was the fact that we were punks from New York City and CBGBs.
Yeah.
And that was the appeal, you know, to the audience.
Yeah, I can never forget how you came on stage dressed. I thought you just didn't have time to change into your costumes.
we decided early on that we weren't going to wear costumes.
Yeah.
We were going to our gimmick was that we were going to wear like the same clothes that our moms gave us for Christmas.
It worked very well. You didn't have to think about it. You know, you can get a polo shirt and some khakis anywhere.
That's right.
And skinny jeans.
I don't know that we were wearing khakis, but we were definitely wearing the polo shirts, the boys.
Yes.
Tina was always very stylish.
Oh, yeah. Still.
Yeah.
Incredible style. And so that, the Ramones, I'd never seen anything like them either. You know, and at first I couldn't understand them, the lyrics.
Hey, Daddy-O, I don't want to go down to the basement.
Yeah. I don't want to walk around with you. There was a lot of I don't want us with the Ramones. There was a lot of, at least they knew what they wanted.
And then that was Dee Dee's influence. You know, Dee Dee was quite the lyricist. And then he also had songs that are Now I Wanna. Yeah.
Now I Wanna Sniff Some Glue.
Yeah, now I want to have something to do.
Oh, yeah. My goodness. The lives we've led. Yeah. Fantastic.
Yeah.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
So this tour progressed and then Talking Heads as a band gave me good stuff to work with, you know. Yourself and Tina and just locked in as a rhythm section and you know, drums and bass are my first love, because without that, there's no mix, you know?
Right, right.
And I also took the tack that I would put the... I didn't have noise gates back then. I didn't have very much to work with. In fact, I didn't even have an external EQ. I had nothing. No
wow.
compressors, nothing. Nothing.
Yeah.
And I had a little built-in thing on the board, and that was it. And we made it work. And it sounded... It sounded fabulous, but I would put the mics under the tom-toms to kind of isolate them a bit, and it made it sound like a timpani. And I think you used those Evans oil-filled heads at one point.
Yeah, I had those Evans heads.
Yeah, which were like oil-filled and very deep sounding.
Uh-huh. Yeah,
especially with a mic stuck up underneath there. The future of the music business, as we know it, is no more. I don't think. I mean, it may come back in some form, but I'm sure audiences are getting hungry for it and pent up demand. But the nuts and bolts of the thing, I mean, it's going to take a lot of putting back together.
You're right. It's I wouldn't say it's never going to happen, but it's going to take a while.
Yeah.
And it's a good thing you and I are such patient people, Frank.
Oh yes. It's one of my finer attributes is my patience. But I do miss it. I do miss it terribly. I miss that, and which goes back to the essence of what I do as a sound guy, and you know, working in conjunction with the band and sculpting songs and sculpting sound, and then the audience in the middle. You know, I miss that audience. I miss hearing applause, and it's not for me, but I'm part of it. Because I'm out there mixing it, you know. And if the audience ain't getting it, then the band knows. We went to Australia and Japan after Europe. The first time we went to Trans-Pacific, we went to New Zealand, where we got off the plane. Yeah. We got off the plane, and there was a press conference. We were like,
I know, and they presented it with. Presented us with a gold record.
Yeah.
And they said you lads are bigger than Rod Stewart.
Oh man, that's funny how people would take to that. And New Zealand, I remember, was just a great people were lovely. It was a great little part of the tour. But I remember waking up in Dunedin in New Zealand, and it looks like Scotland. And I was jet lagged, and B, at that stage in my life, very hungover. And I woke up with my tongue stuck to the pillow, and I looked out the window, and Dunedin's like little grey granite houses with smoke coming out, and green hills with sheep on them. And it's named after Dundee in Edinburgh. It's the combination. So there's people who were born there who talk like me in Dunedin. It's a very Scottish place. And I woke up hungover and jet-lagged, and I had no idea where I was. None.
I think it was cold there, too.
It was brisk.
The southern island.
Yeah.
Southern part of the island.
It was a little brisk.
Yeah.
But then we went to Australia, and I don't think we went to Japan on that trip. I think we just did Australia and New Zealand.
But That's correct.
I seem to remember. And then we went to Japan.
Yes, we flew to Japan from Paris.
That's right. And we came back via Moscow. Did we go via Moscow?
Yes, we went. We didn't come back by Moscow, but
no.
On the way to Tokyo, we had to stop and refuel. In those days, planes only carried so much fuel, and
right.
We had to stop and refuel in Moscow. And when you got off the plane, they it was mandatory that you changed, I think, $5.
Yeah,
into rubles, which we all did. And I remember that at the airport in Moscow, I went to the men's room, and you had to pay like a bunch of rubles just to go into the men's room. And then when I did, there was nothing in the stall but like a hole in the floor.
Yeah, I know, this is the airport, the best dry toilet I ever saw in my life.
Yeah, crazy. But we got right back on the plane as soon as possible and flew to Tokyo, which was fabulous.
Yeah, was that Air France? Did Air France do that? I think it was.
No, I think it was Air Japan.
Oh, Japan.
Because we had sake the entire way, and when I got to Tokyo. I was feeling it, feeling the amount of sake I'd had on the plane.
Yeah, I think I had a triple hangover by the time I got to Tokyo. I'd been, it came in waves. And we had the Plastics, did the Plastics open for us on that particular trip?
I don't think they opened
for
us.
No, I don't think they opened for us. But they
did. I don't know that we even had an opening act. But we met the Plastics at that time because they had designed the tour program.
Right.
They were graphic designers, like serious graphic designers, and they did this they did the posters and the tour program for the promoter who was called Uncle Tom's. No, Tom's Cabin.
Tom's
no
Cabin.
No Uncle.
Right.
Just Tom's Cabin. And they invited us, the band, back to their. They said, "Would you like to jam with us? We don't usually, you know, jam, but or at least we didn't in those days. But we couldn't resist going with the Plastics to jam." And they said, "Come to our studio, and we'll have a jam session." We were imagining, you know, a little recording studio with musical instruments. And what it was like an art studio and pretty tiny, and all they had was like toy instruments, like little toy saxophones and trumpets and guitars and things. And so we had a jam session on toy instruments, which was really fun.
Great people. Yeah. I ended up working with them too, with the Plastics through an introduction when they came to. Yeah, they came to New York, and I did a little tour with them. I actually remixed their first record, their first album, for an American label.
They opened for us in Central Park.
Yep, yeah, I remember that. And someone's got a bootleg of that. Sent me a bootleg of both bands, the Plastics and the. But wasn't that was that the nine piece? Was that the first time we had the nine piece? Or was that?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. It was the debut of what we called the Big Band.
The Big Band.
And it was.
It was big.
Yeah, and we had played a few nights before that at a festival in outside of Toronto called Heat Wave.
Oh yes.
Where which was like a new wave Woodstock. Or that's what it was supposed to be, and it was a, I mean that was where we played the songs from Remain in Light for the first time, and it was before the album had come out, so nobody had heard them or had any idea what was about to happen, you know?
Yeah,
and remember we played and the kids went nuts. We were all kind of nervous, like, what are people going to think? What are they going to think of this? Because this is a big switch from what they might be expecting. And we just slayed them.
Yeah.
To the point that they got mad when we ran out of songs and said, okay, bye. they started a fire underneath the stage. Remember that?
Yeah, there was a little mini riot.
Elvis Costello had to wait for hours before he could go on.
And we had the Pretenders there, the B-52s. Were the police on that?
The police were not. The Clash was supposed to be there, but they never showed up.
Ah. Getting back to audio, I was using an analog board, and I was using a board with whatever was there, you know. I didn't even have a choice, and no sound check, and it's a festival. And I think we got a basic line check on headphones, and then the band got thrown on the stage, and it was just winging it. When the band comes on stage, you get in the zone and you mix the show without even thinking about it too much. It's an instinct that takes over for me anyway. You know, it's not the technical aspect is important. Of course, you've got to at least have the gear and the mics in the right place and the band playing good. But with Talking Heads, and to this day, I still haven't experienced anything like that. And we've had a few laughs as well along the way. It wasn't...
Oh, we certainly did. We certainly did.
I also never worked with a band who would go to museums on their day off, you know?
Yeah.
that was new to me. I mean, where are you going? I'm going to a museum. Oh, really? I'm going to look at some art. And it got me into it as well, you know, so.
That's a really good way to spend a day off when you're on tour, because it can sort of, if you like what you're seeing, especially, it can sort of recharge your batteries.
Yes.
You know, and it can be inspiring. And we would go to art museums, but of course we had been to art school, and you know we had we not been in a band, we would have been making paintings somewhere. Yeah. But Tina and I still, and I'm sure David and Jerry too, we still enjoy a good museum.
Yes, they're fascinating. Yeah. And the other thing about them is they're cheap.
It's mostly
in a lot of European countries, free.
Yeah, that's right. And you get to see the real thing instead of a print of it in a book or a magazine. You see the real Da Vinci or the real Van Gogh or the real Matisse. You know.
Yeah.
And that was exciting.
So I came to America to visit you and do a couple of shows at the Intermedia Theater, and then I stayed. I came back and stayed.
And we were happy to have you, Frank.
Well, it was a great thing, and I ended up sleeping in the loft at a corner of the loft for a little while.
I remember that.
Through circumstances.
You had your own special corner.
I had my own special corner where not too much privacy, as Tina's mother found out.
Yeah.
being caught in flagrante delicato by the bass player's mother, who was French and took it very much in her stride.
Yes, I don't think it was the first time Tina's mother had seen such a thing.
No. Well, you know, I was a boy back then. I had a boy with needs.
Yes, that's right. And you were turned loose in New York City.
Oh man, did I do okay? It was great because coming to America too. Not so much in New York, but when we got out to Texas and other places, and I found out that I was an exotic creature because of the way I talked.
We always had a good time in Texas.
Oh yes, we did. Yes. Austin, Texas, actually was the first place we sold about 2,000 tickets in Austin when we went there. The Armadillo World Headquarters, they were hanging off the rafters.
I remember thinking, they're not going to like us here. They're not going to like us.
Yeah.
When we arrived, because the Armadillo World Headquarters in Austin was a giant Quonset hut with, at the time anyway, the longest bar in Texas. When we pulled up, there was just nothing but motorcycles outside of the building, and we thought, uh-oh, this does not bode well, and yet they loved it.
Yes, they did.
And you know, there's nothing wrong with an audience full of long neck bottles of beer.
And that was the first place. The only thing they gave us in the rider, Talking Heads didn't have a big rider anyway, but the only thing they gave us was nachos and long neck beer. That was it. Everybody got the same thing. And I'd never had a nacho with jalapeno peppers on it before. that's where the beer came in handy, I suppose.
Yes,
but I've heard bootlegs of that. And, you know, these sound systems back then were pretty primitive. You know, there wasn't a lot of finesse to them, but they worked and there was a vibe. Now on that tour, on a subsequent tour, we played a couple of nights at the boarding house in San Francisco.
Yeah.
And I walked in there, and I mean, I would advance with these people and just get a rough idea of what was there. But when they explained to me what this system was, I was going, there's no way this is going to work. And I walked in there, and I withheld judgment, and it was two little column speakers on the wall and a little subwoofer somewhere, and the room itself was so warm, and what was coming off the stage, I just reinforced with the vocals and a bit of kick drum and snare and stuff. It sounded amazing.
Ah.
Amazing.
Very good.
And it turned out that there was a guy there, David Kahn, who produced Pearl Harbor and the Explosions, and he said.
And then he went on to do the Bangles.
Yeah, and Springsteen and a few other things. He was a CBS guy. He worked at CBS, not so much a staff producer. But he said to me, he at that point he came to see Talking Heads. That point, at that point in the boarding house. I think we did two shows a night, two nights. We did four shows. And
yep.
He said he was about to quit the music business, and he coming to see the Talking Heads at the boarding house changed his mind.
Ah.
And true story. And that's with the most primitive little PA with two little mixers cabled together that weren't even the same brand to get 12 channels. And David can. So you just never know who's going to be affected by what you're doing.
Yeah, that's true.
You know, that's why
I remember Robin Williams was there.
Robin Williams also was hanging out with me in the booth. Yeah, smoking my weed and whatever else we had.
I can remember when we played the Roundhouse with the Ramones, and you know, we were all very nervous, and we were getting ready to go on. You were giving us a little pep talk, and Johnny Rotten of the Sex Pistols poked his head in the door of our dressing room and looked around and said, "Oh, I was looking for the Ramones." And you said, "Well, then, F off."
I did say fuck. I did.
Yeah, you did.
Yeah, I love Johnny.
I saw him once on, I think it was, was it David Letterman? The early David Letterman show, or maybe it was Tom, what's his name, that was on late at night?
Tom Schneider.
It might have been Tom Schneider, and he said to Johnny Rotten, whoever the host was, said to Johnny Rotten, "Who do you think is the most overrated band going today?" And Johnny Rotten immediately said, "Talking Heads." I thought to myself, "Oh, that was very nice of him to say that.
At least you got a name check, you know."
Yeah. Now we're famous.
Yeah. Somebody doesn't like us. And then, so fast forward a little more, and you called me up. I parted company with Talking Heads. I went on to do work at Irving Plaza, open Irving Plaza, and run it for a couple of years, get off the road.
Yeah.
And then you called me up and said, "Tom Tom Club are doing 2 weeks at CBGB's. Would you be interested in coming to mix
yeah.
it?"
Uh-huh.
And, yeah. Because I never mixed Talking Heads at CBGB's. By the time I got to New York, you were gone from there. You know, we didn't play the club. We didn't play the clubs in New York anymore. We were playing Boston, Philadelphia, eventually Jersey, Washington D.C., and playing bigger places. And so to get Tom Tom Club back in CBGB's and that sound system, it was fabulous. It was unbelievable. Yeah. This, if you could get past the smell of the place. The sound system was fabulous. It just worked.
Yes.
It just worked.
And remember, it would overheat because it was late summer, early fall, and were we doing two sets? I guess we were just doing one set.
We're doing one set, and I don't think there was an opener. I don't think we had an opener.
Oh, we did. We did have a different opening act every night.
Oh yeah.
And it was not 14 nights, it was 15 nights, 5 nights a week over 3 weeks.
Oh, wow.
And nobody had ever done that at CBGB's before or since.
Right.
That was the longest run anybody had there. And it was packed.
Oh,
and
yeah.
It got so hot in there that the amps for the PA system would begin to overheat.
Yeah, and I remember putting fans on them, extra fans on them, but it was just blowing hot air, and you couldn't get to the stage. We had to come through the rubble and come in the back door to even get. Well, there was no dressing room. It was just brutal. It was just brutal.
Yeah.
So basically, you'd come in, go on the stage, and try and get out of there.
But we had a good time, and we had special guests like Debbie Harry and Dee Dee Ramone, and then finally on the last night, Lou Reed.
Yeah.
And it was a wonderful time. Really good.
All right, old thing. Well, thank you so much.
Lovely to speak to you, Frank, and good luck with your podcast and your book and anything else you got going on.
Thanks very much for plugging in. We can't do it without you. And don't forget to check out our website, soundmanconfidential.com, for news and my upcoming shows and all the fabulous guests you're going to have the pleasure of listening to. Catch you next time. Soundman Confidential is produced by Alan Black with our team, Chip Bentley on sound production, web design Addy Bell, original music Paul Westwater, and public relations Paddy DeVries at Devious Planet Media.